Thank you so much for coming to this. This is a real honor for me to be here at the Hay Festival. This is my first trip to Colombia, not my first to this part of the world, but the first to this beautiful country of yours, and I'm really grateful to be here. My name is Alana Mitchell, and I'm a journalist from Canada, and I write about science issues, and the book that I'm going to be talking about is this one. It's called Seasick, which is a play on words. It's about how humans have made the sea sick. It's but also about, of course, it's a play on the mal de mer that we get when we travel on the ocean. And I wanted to let you know about why I wrote this book. This book was first published in 2009 and has been published all over the world, some in translation. It's recently won quite a big prize in the U.S. for environmental journalism. And I wanted to tell you why I wrote it. I didn't write it because I knew that there was something terribly wrong with the ocean. I wrote it because I was incredibly curious about how the ocean works. And the reason I'm curious about that kind of stuff is that I am the daughter of a biologist. My father taught biology in Canada at a university, and that meant for me growing up, you know, going off to the university every weekend to feed all the little rats in the lab, you know, and trying to figure out how they worked. And my dad's profession was not just to teach biology, but it was also to try to understand how ecology works. He was one of the first ecologists in the world, and that meant that he was always trying to put pieces together of how systems worked on the planet. It was a new field when he started. It's still relatively new, and it's in fact related to the field of conservation. Conservation is a field born of crisis, as we all know, crisis in the planetary systems. So he was one of the first people to do that, and it meant that in the summers, you know, every summer we would all pile into one of these terrible old North American cars called station wagons. Does anybody know what a station wagon is? They're these horrible old things that they don't even, you know, yeah. And we didn't have air conditioning, and we didn't have seat belts, and there would be four kids, baby on my mother's lap, diaper pail at her feet, and we would be bumping along the prairies in the middle part of Canada, looking always for a piece of the ecosystem that my father wanted to figure out. That was how we spent all our summers. And that intellectual curiosity, that belief in science, and the belief that science can answer some of these questions just infused my life. And so when I became a journalist, worked for 14 years for the Canada's national newspaper, which is called the Globe and Mail, and also for several years for the Financial Post, trying to figure out economic systems. These are Canadian newspapers. When my career started, I decided that I needed to try to apply that curiosity to all of the things that I did. So I spent a lot of years writing about the environment as I understood it then, which was what's happening on land and what's happening in the air. So I did a lot of writing about climate change. I did a lot of writing about, you know, going to places like Madagascar to figure out why why the forests were vanishing in Madagascar and what was happening to the animals. I was focused very much on a very traditional type of journalism, which was to look at what we were doing to the land and the air. And I was in Galapagos, just, you know, not too very far from here on the islands, at the very end of writing my first book, which was all about climate change and what we were doing to habitat. And I was on a ship doing research with some scientists, one of whom is the famous American scientist Sylvia Earle, who invented a bunch. She's a generation or two older than I am, and invented a lot of the machines to go very deep in the ocean. And she was famous for going down very deep in the ocean when she was about 8 months pregnant with her first child, and she scandalized, you know, the scientific community when she did this many years ago. And she spent so much time in the deeper part of the ocean that she's known as her deepness, which fascinated me. And I was on a research vessel with her in Galapagos, and we were looking at some of the things that were happening in the ocean. And I was really impatient with this because I was finishing my last book, which was about land and air, and she only wanted to look at the ocean, and so did the other scientists I was with, and I wanted to look at these islands, these volcanic islands that had so fascinated Charles Darwin 150 years earlier. And I said to her at one point, you know, she's a tiny little woman like this, and she intimidated me terribly. I thought, oh, this woman, she's so famous, and I was bunking with her. I was in the same berth with her on the ship, so we shared, you know, the bed and the bathroom and that kind of thing. And I was terrified of her. And finally, one day I turned to her and said, "Why are you studying the ocean? Why have you spent your whole life studying the ocean? Why not study the land, the creatures that live in air?" And she turned to me, full, 4'9" height like this, and she said, "Well, my dear, because the ocean is where the life is." And my whole world shifted. For the first time, I understood that I had been looking not at the whole planet, as I thought I had been looking at, but only at a very tiny portion of it. And it galvanized me, because here was this famous biologist telling me that I had not understood. Here I was writing a book that, I thought was comprehensive, and it wasn't at all comprehensive. So I immediately started researching about the ocean. I just started reading and reading and reading, and I knew nothing about the biological importance of the ocean whatsoever. So I started reading up, and what I discovered astounded me. I had no idea that the ocean is as important to the workings of the planet as, in fact, it is. I mean, one of the things I discovered is that 99% of the living space on the planet is in the ocean. I had no idea, no idea at all. And that the ocean contains the building blocks for life. In fact, for most of the time of the 3.5 billion years that there has been life on the planet, there's been life only in the ocean. And to scientists, the ocean controls the carbon cycle, it controls much of the oxygen cycle. Every second breath you breathe contains oxygen produced by plankton in the ocean. I always thought it was the trees, but it's not the trees, it's the plankton that control the oxygen cycle. So the building blocks of life are actually in the global ocean. As one scientist put it to me, he said, if everything that lives in air were to die tomorrow, everything in the ocean would be fine. But if everything in the ocean were to die tomorrow, everything on land would die as well. So the ocean contains what scientists call the switch of life. It actually contains the catalyst for life and the future of life on the ocean, and so on the planet. And so I thought to myself, well, what are we doing? So we know this, that it's that the ocean is so critical to life, but what is actually happening to the ocean? And I knew about fish, I knew about a few things like that, but I had no concept ever of what is actually happening to the global ocean at our hand. And what I discovered astounded me. It led me to 2.5 years of research, 13 journeys around the world with scientists, because that's what I do. I go and talk to scientists. And it convinced me that what's happening to the ocean is a hidden crisis. It's something that we don't normally talk about, and it's actually even more important than climate change on our planet. It's connected, but it's a bigger system. When you start to affect the atmosphere, it's one thing, but when you start to affect the ocean as a system, that's something totally different, and it's even more grave, even more dangerous, even more frightening. So what did I discover? Well, the first thing I did, because this is how I, this is how I work, I go and talk to scientists. And so I went to, I emailed, some scientists who are really fabulous on coral reefs. I started my research just not very far from here, actually, in Bocas del Toro in Panama, where the Smithsonian Institution has been looking at corals for quite a long time. And I didn't even really know what a coral was. I'd never seen one. I remember I still have drawings in my sketchbook from the scientist Nancy Knowlton, who I was working with, who showed me what they are and explained their biology. And they're incredibly primitive animals that rely on phytoplankton to live within their cells to survive. They're a symbiotic animal that relies on plants to photosynthesize the energy from the sun and the light to survive. And she was looking at a coral spawning. And I said, well, what is a coral spawn? She'd been studying these for years. And she said, well, that's the one time in the year when these animals reproduce. And I said, well, how do you know when it happens? And she said, well, it's one of the great mysteries of life, but the ones that we were looking at are these great big huge Montastrea species. You probably know them. They're the great big huge reef builders in the Caribbean. And she said, these particular ones that we're going to look at usually spawn between 5 and 7 days after the last full moon of summer, 100 minutes after sunset. And I said, you're kidding me. How do they know? They don't have brains. They only have one orifice. They can't even move. How do they know when to spawn? And she said, it's one of the great mysteries, but it's also one of the great biological wonders of the world to actually witness one of these things. Scientists didn't even know how they reproduced until about 20 years ago, and they happened on it at the Great Barrier Reef. So the year I went with her to do the research was 2005, which you, because you live here in Colombia on the Mediterranean, will know was an incredibly warm year in the Mediterranean. And we flew into Bocas del Toro, and the first thing we heard was that all sorts of corals all over the reef were bleached. Bleached means that they had expelled the little phytoplankton that live inside their cells that contain the color of a coral. So they were white like your shirts, and those, you could see the flesh shredding off the coral structures that they had built. It was really uncertain whether they would even spawn that year because they were so sick. You know, they were so damaged, and the thing is that they put together energy all year for that one moment in the year when they can potentially reproduce. So we got there, and night after night after night, there was a whole assemblage of a couple of dozen scientists who were, you know, we would get into the water night after night with our snorkel gear and our scuba gear, and we would shine these lights on these corals to see whether they were getting ready to spawn. Night after night after night, they weren't doing it. Night after night, we were in despair, thinking that maybe, you know, maybe the Caribbean was too hot that summer for this ancient ritual of birth to actually take place. Finally, one night we got into the water, and it was magical. It was absolutely magical. From the first second we entered the water, we could feel the electricity of this reef coursing through our bodies. It was absolutely extraordinary. The little worms were going crazy. The brittle stars were dancing on the reef like this, popping out these huge big eggs, these ruby red eggs. And at exactly 100 minutes after sunset, the Montestrella started to release their little bundles of eggs and sperm. They're hermaphrodites, so they release both. These little pink bundles started floating up to the surface of the water, and there was this sort of this incredible energy on the reef. Anything that wasn't reproducing was eating. It was like an orgy, a coral orgy on the reef, and it was just incredible to feel it and to smell it and to see that this was this incredible dance of life happening as it happens only once a year ever for these species. And so we followed some of these little coral bundles, and we could see them, you know, as they mixed with other genetic material throughout the Caribbean. And we captured some of them in phytoplankton nets and took them back to the lab where we were going to wait until, you know, wait until about 4 in the morning until we could see whether they had reached the 16 cell stage, and that meant that they would have been viable. And we were really, really excited about all this. We thought, oh, you know, after all this hardship, after all the bleaching, they actually, you know, some of them actually spawned. We may be able to witness this, you know, this magic of birth here in this very sick ocean, and sick part of the ocean. And we were feeling kind of macho about it, you know, like we're calling ourselves Team Spawn, you know, and going back to the lab to look at these things. By 4 in the morning, a lot of that energy had dissipated, a lot of that excitement, because what we realized was that only about half of the corals that should have spawned that night did. The others probably were too sick. And only about half of the corals that had emitted, half of the embryos that we looked at that evening had reached the 16 cell stage. So what we saw was only about 25%, a quarter, of the corals that could have reproduced that actually did. And it felt, you know, maybe given the warmth of that year and the sickness of the corals, maybe that was a fabulous, you know, a fabulous spawn. But to us that evening, it felt like we were witnessing death in the midst of this ritual of birth. And we knew as well that the Caribbean corals have been particularly hard hit around the world. So something like 80%, that's 80% of the corals in the Caribbean have died off over the last 30 years. And for those of you who live here, you must know that it's quite hard now to find baby corals in the Caribbean. Scientists get really excited if they find baby corals because there are so few of them. And this is part of a phenomenon that is happening to corals all over the world. 20% of corals around the world, if you look at the global coral structure, have died, and 50%, another 50% on top of that, are really in terrible shape. We know that as we affect the global ocean, and this was my revelation at the time, here I was, you know, witnessing the wonder of the of this incredible ecosystem. We realized that as we affect the ocean, all of these effects actually intersect at coral reefs, to the point that coral reefs, it's thought, by in about 20 years, if we don't do, you know, if we don't change some of our actions as humanity, it could be as little as 20 years before all coral reefs in the world are extinct. It's astonishing. It's absolutely astonishing. That would represent the first death of a whole ecosystem in the globe from global climate and ocean change. So what are the phenomena that are affecting this? Well, for me, it galvanized me to go and do a whole bunch more research and eventually to write this book. And what I discovered is that scientists are incredibly worried about three phenomena that have to do with the global ocean, because the ocean is just one system. It's just one ocean. I know we think about it as the seven seas, and we think about it as, you know, as the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic and the Pacific, but in fact, it's one interconnected system. And we have begun to affect the system as a whole, not just little bits of it, which was the original, you know, concern of scientists, but in fact, we started to affect the chemistry of the entire global ocean in ways that are unprecedented for millions and millions of years. And they, and all of these different effects are greater than the sum of their parts. So instead of just being a few little things spread out over the ocean, we have done something that is affecting the ocean's ability to support life as we know it. And so I'm going to talk to you about three of them. The three that I'm going to talk to you about are the ones that scientists are most worried about. And the first one has to do with oxygen. So the ocean is made up of, you know, water, which is hydrogen and oxygen together in a molecule. But it also has a lot of dissolved oxygen in it. And that's what fish use to breathe. It's what creatures need to live in, you know, big parts of the global ocean. And I spent about 2 weeks a couple of years ago on a ship in the Gulf of Mexico, which of course we've all been hearing about because of the great big spill that happened there this summer. But the fact is that there's a much bigger and more insidious problem in the Gulf of Mexico that has to do with dissolved oxygen. And what's happened is that there is this enormous dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. The year I was there, it was 17 and a half square kilometers just in area. That doesn't count its depth. And what it means is that there's very little or no dissolved oxygen in that huge, big swath of the coastal waters. And this should be just filled with life. There should just be everything living in there. There was before this dead zone started to form a couple of decades ago. And so I was with a crew of scientists, and we were looking at, you know, putting all these instruments through this water to see what was living there. We were looking even at the microbial structure, at the little phytoplankton, but the viruses and everything, right down to the smallest creatures, and the big ones as well, to see what was there. And there was nothing. It was astonishing. We would trawl with these fishing nets at different heights, periodically, at the same, you know, periods of the day. Every couple of hours, we would go and trawl. And we would trawl and trawl and trawl, and nothing was in our nets. It got to the point that the scientist I was working with said, we must have faulty nets. There can't be so little in the ocean, in this part of the ocean that should be so alive. And so we cruised with our ship outside the dead zone, it's called a dead zone, into the part of the ocean where, that we knew had oxygen, because we were testing the oxygen levels, and trawled, and of course there were fish. But in this huge swath of the coastal ocean in the Gulf of Mexico, there was absolutely nothing. And the phenomenon works like this. It's basically all up and down the Mississippi River, which runs, you know, like a backbone through the continent of North America. There are farmers, and they're putting chemicals, synthetic chemicals, nitrogen and phosphorus, on their fields. These are fertilizers for plants, soy and corn and that kind of thing, all up and down. And a whole bunch of this, they put on too much. Year after year after year, they put on too much. And so instead of feeding the plants that they're trying to sell to the market, these chemicals wash into the river through the whole watershed, wash down the Mississippi River, and go off into the Gulf of Mexico like a faucet. There's this huge push of synthetic chemicals. And there's still fertilizers for plants once they get to the ocean, except now they're feeding plants that live in the water, the phytoplankton. And the phytoplankton go crazy with this stuff. For them, this is like the all-you-can-eat banquet of all time, right? They reproduce like crazy, make all of these what we know as algal blooms. The algal blooms cover big swaths of the Gulf and fall. They die, fall to the bottom of the sea, to the floor of the sea, and then the second part of the process takes over. Bacteria start to decompose all of these things, and as the bacteria decompose all of these plants, they use up all the oxygen. And from one little spot on the floor of the bed at the mouth of the Gulf of Mexico. Of the Mississippi, this dead zone spreads along the bottom and in some cases right up to the surface of the water. And then nothing can live. So it's littered with carcasses, this dead zone, of things that can't move away. And it's dead in other ways as creatures flee this lack of oxygen. They just sort of move away to other parts of the ocean. And it means that fishermen can't catch anything. It means that, you know, they have to use more energy getting further and further away. The thing that's astonishing, though, to somebody like me, as I look at it, is that the number of these dead zones in coastal waters around the world has increased so dramatically. So when I finished the first draft of my book, Seasick, the official number of dead zones in coastal waters around the world was 200. By the time I finished doing the revisions, the official number was 407, which is where it still stands. And the scary thing to scientists, so this phenomenon is spreading rather quickly, and the phenomenal thing to scientists is that three of those dead zones are caused not by chemicals running into the water, you know, the way they do in the Gulf of Mexico, they're caused by changes to climate that are affecting current structures. So in three separate massive current structures in parts of the world, like, you know, off the coast of Oregon and Washington, there are these huge dead zones that are forming. And the reason that scientists are worried about those is that because they're not caused by this going into that water, they can spread really quickly and without any expectation. It's very hard to anticipate where they're going to be next. So this is one of the great problems. So that's oxygen. The other one that really keeps scientists awake at night is the phenomenon of ocean acidification. Does anybody know about ocean acidification? I'm just interested. You know about it? So there's a little bit of knowledge about it. This is what's happening is that we're actually changing the pH of the global ocean. And this is something that scientists until just about 10 years ago simply didn't think that we could do. They really believed, for all of the generations that we've studied the ocean, they really believed that the ocean was unchangeable, immutable. They had no idea that we could change something as fundamental as the acidity of the ocean, the pH level. But what they discovered, and the very first paper on this came out in 1999, but what they've discovered is that as we burn fossil fuels, and fossil fuels are just plants and animals that lived millions of years ago, but as we burn them, we put the carbon from those millions of years ago into today's atmosphere. And that's, you know, why we have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now than we did before we started burning fossil fuels. But about a third of that ancient carbon that we've put into the atmosphere has been absorbed into the surface of the global ocean, right across the whole surface of the ocean. In the air, we know that it causes climate change. It holds heat against the body of the planet. All this extra carbon dioxide is holding more heat against the planet. But it's inert. It doesn't react chemically. It's just part of the atmosphere, greater and greater part. In the ocean, carbon dioxide mixes with water and creates, it's chemically reactive. There's a chemical reaction going on in the water out here. And what's happening is that it's creating carbonic acid. The thing is, we put so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere with ancient carbon, and now so much into the ocean that it's made the ocean roughly 30% more acidic today than it was before we started burning fossil fuels. That's an extraordinary change in just the blink of an eye geologically. And what it means is that today the ocean surface waters, meaning to 3,000 meters, are more acidic than they've been in 55 million years. Scientists didn't even know this could happen. I went down to, I was in Puerto Rico at a conference talking with a, with one of the first scientists to figure out this phenomenon. Her name is Joni Kleypas, and she works in America. And she said that when she and the other scientists back in 1999 figured out what was happening, they just couldn't believe it. They literally, she said they had never been taught at school that this phenomenon could happen. They had to sit down and work out the basic chemistry. They actually wrote a paper on the basic chemistry of how can this phenomenon happen, because they were so baffled by it. But they, of course, they've done testing and sampling throughout the ocean, and they can tell that it is happening, and they're looking at the effects. But she said when she finally figured out what was happening, she literally got up from her seat and ran to the bathroom and threw up, because the implications of an increasingly acidic ocean are so extraordinary. They're so amazing. And what does it do? What does it matter if the ocean is more acidic? Well, scientists are still trying to figure out some of the implications, but one of the things they know for sure is that as the ocean becomes more acidic, the calcium that is in the ocean, that's one of the building blocks of life, it's what, you know, the coral reefs make their reefs out of, it's what creatures make their bones and teeth out of, all that kind of stuff. The calcium that is in the ocean is not available to creatures to use in the same way. So they're having much more trouble building their bones and their shells and their skeletons and all of those things. And the coral reefs, of course, are very greatly affected by this. And they've already seen, there's been enough acidification happening in the ocean that scientists can already point to places where shells are thinner, where bones are not as robust. Eventually, if we don't, you know, reduce the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere, eventually the ocean will become acidic enough that it begins to corrode the shells that creatures are making. And that phenomenon is already happening in the Southern Ocean around Antarctica. I just got back from Antarctica about 2 weeks ago. I was on a research trip down there. And already, because the water is colder and is absorbing more CO2, carbon dioxide, you can already see that shells are starting to corrode in those southern oceans and in the Arctic Ocean as well. So this is a phenomenon, again, that has completely taken scientists by surprise. They would never have expected this. And they can see other effects as well. There's a huge effect on fish of an increasingly acidic ocean. Fish become stupid. Instead of swimming away from the things that are going to eat them, they swim toward the things that are going to eat them. For some strange reason, it seems to affect their sense of smell, the greater acidity. Creatures can't maintain their own internal chemistry, so their digestive systems just sort of go nutty. They can't seem to digest food. They can't seem to, you know, maintain their own basic pH inside themselves. Some creatures do fine. It's just not clear which ones do well and which ones don't, and that's one of the great mysteries of this. So we've got oxygen, we've got acidity. The third thing that's happening is temperature. And of course, as we put all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it warms up. It traps heat against the planet. About 80% of that extra heat has been absorbed into the ocean. And for decades, scientists said, oh, isn't that great? There's the ocean saving us from all this climate change because it's absorbing the heat, you know, and isn't that wonderful? Except that now they've discovered that actually the temperature of the ocean, surface waters of the ocean, is changing too in ways that they never expected could happen. They always thought that the ocean was unchangeable, and now they're discovering that it's not. And I remember going to the aquarium in Plymouth in England. Plymouth overlooks the Plymouth Sound. It's, you know, way up. It's in the south of England. And they have this huge new aquarium there that opened in 1998. In 1998, the centerpiece of this thing is a big Mediterranean tank. And so you literally stand under the tank like this and look up, and you can see all these creatures swimming above you that, you know, are in the Mediterranean. Except that today, in 2011, they can't call it the Mediterranean tank anymore, because so many of the creatures in that tank now live and reproduce in the Plymouth Sound, right outside the window. They've moved up. They've moved up because they're looking for cooler waters. And that phenomenon is happening right through the global ocean. And things are moving at different stages, in different ways, in different numbers. So this whole dance of life that has evolved in the ocean to support the kind of life that we know is shifting around in ways that scientists aren't even clear about. It's called mismatch. So things don't match. The things that, you know, if you have a fish that needs to eat this fish to survive, that needs to eat this fish, all of those chains in the whole dance have shifted around. And it's not clear how they're going to resolve. One of the great effects is on plankton. Plankton, you know, that produce every second breath you breathe, many of them have shells made of calcium carbonate, the same as lime, the same as the limestone reefs that, you know, you see here in the Caribbean. Plankton have these little calcium carbonate shells, and it's not clear what's happening to those. Do they still produce those shells in a more acidic, a warmer, a shifted ocean? Is that still going to happen? And if they don't, what are the implications? These are all the building blocks of life for the planet, and they're shifting around. So it's so here I am. I mean, I'm just a journalist, right? I'm not a scientist. I'm not trained to look at these things. I've just been wandering around the world looking at this, and it was incredibly scary because every time I would learn something new, I would go on another journey, you know, to another scientific cruise, and I would tell the scientists what I was finding. And the scientists would say, "Really?" They didn't know that all of these things were happening at the same time. Nobody has been putting the pieces together. If you look at climate scientists and negotiators, international negotiators, like the negotiations we just had in Cancun for the Kyoto Protocol, the issues of ocean acidification and the relationship to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are not on the agenda. They're not in discussion anywhere in the world at that international level. So it's like this hidden phenomenon that somehow even scientists, finally scientists are starting to raise their voices and say, yes, this is a big issue. It should be on the agenda of these big international meetings. But that only happened for the first time 1 year ago. So it's all these pieces haven't been put together. This whole picture has not been clear. So for me, as a journalist wandering around looking at this, I became incredibly despairing. I became depressed. I eventually went to bed for about a month. I couldn't get myself out of bed. I thought to myself, why am I writing a book about this? It's insanity. You know, why am I killing more trees printing a book? I couldn't even finish. I just didn't even think I could finish my contract. I couldn't imagine actually sitting down and writing this stuff so people would have to read it, because it's so sad. And every single trend line in this story is going in the wrong way. So if you think about the global ocean as a patient going off to the doctor, you know, you take all the vital signs of a patient, you take cholesterol and weight and, you know, blood sugar and all that kind of thing. In every single case, the vital signs are going in the wrong way. So I went to bed, and I had one more journey left that I, you know, was supposed to do before I finished my book. And I couldn't make myself do it. I just thought, I this is just too much for me. But I'm a journalist, and I had spent ages and ages setting up this final journey, which was to be to the bottom of the ocean, to 3,000 feet in a submersible. And these things are, you know, to go on a scientific journey to the very deep ocean. And these trips are incredibly hard to arrange. It took me, you know, a couple of years to get myself on this submersible, a berth on the submersible. So finally, I was in Toronto, and I just pulled myself out of bed, literally just pulled myself out of bed, and got on another airplane, you know, which is putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and flew down to Florida and then off the coast of Cuba to go into on this scientific cruise. And we were looking at creatures in the deep ocean to try to find cures for cancer, which is, of course, incredibly ironic, because here we are, you know, damaging the life support system of the planet and yet trying to get more creatures out of it to try to cure a few individuals. So there was this huge sense of irony, but also, I suppose, of hope in it. So I'm on this ship. I'm part of a scientific crew of about 30 people. Many of them have been down below, you know, to the deep ocean a lot, but several of us hadn't been. And I'm on there. It's the very first day, and the scientist points to me and says, "You, Mitchell, you're the one who's going to be the first newbie, the first new person on the submersible. It's your turn." And I was terrified. So all this despair I had felt over the planet vanished. and I just became scared for myself. It wasn't about the big picture anymore. It was just about survival for me. And she points to me and tells me I'm going to have to do this. And so I'm standing there looking at this submersible. And the submersible isn't attached to the ship. It's just, it just goes, it goes off the side of the ship and goes down to 3,000 feet. And then if you're really lucky, it comes back up again on battery power, right? And I'm standing there looking at this thing. It's a sphere. So it's this huge, big plexiglass sphere at the front. And the pilot and the scientist are there, and they have all these robotic arms that they're going to use to take creatures from the deep sea and put them onto the submersible and take them up to the surface. But that's not where I'm going to be. The scientist is pointing to the back of this thing, and at the very back of this thing is this tiny little capsule. It's made of aluminum, and it's like two bathtubs, one on top of the other. It's this incredibly tiny little space. And it has two little portholes like this, that, you know, and I'm going to be in there with one other person. And in this capsule are contained all of the electronics that are going to keep us all alive while we're at 3,000 feet, right? And I'm standing there looking at this thing thinking, I'm not sure I can go in this. I mean, I would have to lie down like this to fit, and I wasn't even sure it would, I wasn't even sure I could breathe in this place. And one of the scientists comes over to me and says, how are you doing? And I'm standing there looking at this. I have to climb up a ladder and get into this little, I've begun to think of it as a coffin at the back of the submersible. And I'm looking at her and I say to her, I'm really, really scared. And she is a very fine scientist, but she is not a psychotherapist. And her words to me at this point are, oh, it's all right, dear. Nobody's died in that back chamber now for quite a few years. And she goes on to explain to me how the last guys died in this back chamber that I'm going to go in a few minutes, which has to do with the fact that they're breathing recycled air and they have to scrub the carbon dioxide out and put it into the ocean and feed in some more oxygen. And she said, oh, but it's okay, dear. We fixed the scrubber. You should be fine. Just keep away from the fan. Don't cover it up with your back. And with that, I mean, what do you do with that? So I just climbed up, got into this thing, and I'm lying down like this. And, the engineer for this trip gets in there as well. And he's a bigger man. He's a big man. He looks remarkably like the American actor George Clooney, right? And I think to myself, there are worse ways to go, But so his head is there lying down, and my head is here. We're sort of, head to toe lying down in this thing. Every now and again, I'm looking through this little porthole. And I keep expecting, and we go down at 100 feet a minute to 3,000 feet. We're seeing part of the world no one has ever seen before. No human eyes had seen this. And I keep expecting the wonder to overtake me. And I mean, I spent 2.5 years researching the ocean, and all of a sudden I'm in the ocean at a very great depth. I'm the only journalist in the world to have gone that deep, I'm told. And I kept expecting to feel pleasure and wonder and awe, and I didn't. I didn't feel any of it. I was just terrified. I was absolutely terrified. I kept thinking about the weight of all of this water and the fact that it wanted to be where I was. And I couldn't get over it. And I'm seeing all these incredible life forms at the bottom because the scientists are shining their lights really, and we see these little, these lobsters that have these big white eyes at the top, and we're seeing these things that I know they have ancestors that lived 3.5 billion years ago, some of the earliest creatures on Earth. There's a little swarm of fish. They're exactly the same size as my little fingernail, and delicate pink. And they're swimming by the porthole. And still, I just want to see when this is going to end. Until finally, I have an epiphany. Finally, down there at 3,000 feet, I had an epiphany, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. I'm just reading a little bit from my book here. Okay. So here we are. We're really, really deep. Like the rest of the planet's deep water, the batch our submersible is in right now is made up of water of different ages, created in all sorts of different places at different times. It is forever in motion, but different parts of it are moving in different directions. As we forage around down here, we cut across the dimension of time through past, present, and future water. And there's another layer of time laid over top of this. Some of the biological processes of this part of the ocean are local and immediate, like the plankton blooms at the surface or the day-to-day activity of fish and other creatures. Some are tied to the ocean's seasonal cycles, some to annual patterns, and some to events that happen only once in several million years. It's like being immersed in the Australian Aboriginal concept of the dream time, which we sometimes think of as any when. When time ceases being a straight line or even a cycle, and all time exists simultaneously. Before, I have understood this idea only in my head. Now I feel it. I live it. It is indescribably shattering. People who go to extreme environments, including astronauts and deep divers, often report odd experiences. It has something to do with being pushed past a limit. Some become emotional, focusing on intensely personal issues, such as an unresolved relationship with a parent. Others turn to a religious faith, and yet others go on a surprising intellectual journey to the abstract. And this is where I have gone, deep into the theories of time and dimension. And now the epiphany comes. My fear vanishes, and so does my despair. I feel as though I have burst through this cramped space and out into the whole world. I'm flooded with hope, with a sweet consciousness of the rich march of time, stretching from the deep past to the remote future, each moment containing all the others. It's impossible to think only in the self-indulgent, despairing, fearful present when surrounded by life across these four dimensions. All this time, through all of these voyages, I've been trying to reason my way to hope, to convince myself that hope is justified, to build a case. It's the question I asked all of the scientists I met. In fact, hope just is. You choose it. You can't run through a checklist to get to it. It is absurd and irrational, but like love, it is human. Like laughter, hope catches and spreads. It expands logarithmically, like the changes now underway on our planet, and like our growing understanding of them, and of course, like our powerful collective human ability to start coping with them. That doesn't mean hope is naive. Shivering in my undersea womb, peering at these wondrous ancient life forms, it occurs to me that we are in an era that holds out the potential of magnificent regeneration. We could, if enough of us wanted to, form a new relationship with our planet. We could become the gentle symbionts we were meant to be, instead of the planetary parasites we have unwittingly become. Instead of sending the ocean lurching further into an irrevocably altered state, maybe humans will irrevocably alter our relationship to it and understand that we must keep it healthy if we are to save ourselves. The point, as one of the scientists explained to me, is that biology, and that includes our species, is at work all the time. It is flexible, adaptable. It works in four dimensions all at once: breadth, width, depth, and time. It can always surprise us. It can always do the unexpected. That is the ocean's prophecy. Thank you. We have time for some questions. If anybody has some questions, I'd be pleased to answer them. Yes.
It sounds that in the near future...
Sorry?
It sounds in the near future it's going to be very difficult for the human beings to change its relationship with the ocean. So what to do? You just saw the failure of negotiations in Cancun. Yep. we can't foresee a change in the short term of any dynamics regarding climate change, and things are going to get worse before it gets better. What can we do in the interim?
What would I do?
Yes.
Or what would I tell you to do?
What would you tell us to do? And what it's possible to do?
What is possible? Well, here's what I know. It has, as you know too, it's really about the concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's the key. So, you know, people talk about what are the priorities. That's the only one. Carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. So the key is to reduce not only what we put into the atmosphere, but also we have to take some out. We have to take some of the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere through planting trees or, you know, whatever it is. There are different ways of doing that. But it all has to center around carbon dioxide. That's the key to the whole thing. How you do that, you're absolutely right that, you know, our international negotiations have failed miserably. They have been an utter failure. Today, as we stand here, as we all are here, we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere more quickly than at any time since humans appeared on the planet, despite all that we know about it and despite all that we can do to prevent that. So that part is true. But what's also true is that we know what we have to do to get those emissions down and to get concentrations down too. There are all sorts of plans that have been put together, not just for country by country by country, but for our species as a whole. There are lots of them. There's the Stanford Wedge Plan that, you know, you have to do this and this and this and this and this. And those actions are clear. We have the technology we need. We have the plans we need. What we lack is the culture of change. We are not committed. Our species is not committed to fixing this. Perhaps we don't know how serious it is. But what's required is not even political will. It's our will as people, as a species. But what we do know, too, is that if we all decide to do it, we still have time. That's why I keep hope. We still actually have a very, very small window of time in which we can forestall the worst of the crisis to come. This is a period that is a unique opportunity in the whole history of humanity. And it's up to us to keep hope enough to make it happen. Okay. You have a question?
Mm-hmm. Continuing on that, have you researched or heard about any of the recent efforts to revitalize failing coral systems? For example, in Japan, where they've developed some sort of battery technology, they implant these microchips into these failing coral systems around their island, and it almost revitalizes systems. It spurts them to start reproducing again.
Right. Yeah. That's how do I be polite about that? That's called In football, American football, if there's absolutely nothing else you can do and you're almost at the very end of the game and you're still a little bit, you do this thing called a Hail Mary pass. So you throw the football and think if it gets anywhere near the goal line, that'll be enough. This is called a Hail Mary pass in biological terms. There's absolutely, it's not that it's not worth doing. It's just that the changes that are needed to make corals survive go so far beyond that. And they have to do with concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, mainly.
Right. In the article that I read, it was still only a 10% chance of revitalization of the coral reefs.
But it doesn't matter if they're revitalized to that degree, because they will eventually die because of heat and sea level rise and because of the acidity of the ocean. So all of those phenomena that are affecting the global ocean are uniquely affecting coral reefs all over the world.
Right. It's a much longer term solution that's needed.
Right. It's a longer term solution.
Thank you.
Sorry.
I wanted to ask you how you would approach climate change skeptics. Because, you know, you hear these surveys on the radio that a frightening proportion of people refuse to believe. And I think belief seems to be the key. In that lovely passage you read, you were talking about hope being almost unreasoning. And it seems to me that some people just don't want to believe that there is climate change. And I find it very difficult myself when I talk to them how to deal with them. How do you deal with them?
It's funny because when I talk to people who don't, you know, who say they don't believe in climate science and ocean science, I actually use a cancer metaphor. And the way I think of it in my own head is this, that, you know, I don't believe in cancer, but I am convinced by the scientific and medical evidence that cancer cells exist and that they can affect a human body and that there are things we can do to try to prevent them from killing humans, you know, taking the tumors out, using nutrition, chemotherapy, all these. I mean, I've known people who've died and who've survived from cancer. And so I don't believe in cancer as a phenomenon, but I'm persuaded that it exists. And I feel the same way about the science. I don't believe in climate and ocean change. It's not a faith system for me. It's an empirical body of incredibly robust evidence, and I've read a lot of it. And so when I talk to people who say I don't believe in climate change, it's like somehow you can take this massive body of evidence, scientific research from decades, that is absolutely compelling, and you can say, I choose not to believe that, just like I choose not to believe in Santa Claus. And it's not the same thing. You know, if you are determined to be anti-scientific, then I don't think you can really persuade people like that. I try to encourage people to read the literature. It's unfortunately, it's very, very compelling literature. Is there anybody else?
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to share like an experience with you and then ask you what your opinion is.
Okay.
I have a friend. She's an artist and she's a painter, but she paints only plants. So this is an earth thing. She made this project in which she discovered that land left alone, not taken care of, not anything, just grew back
right.
With native plants.
Right.
So she explored all this capacity that the earth has to adapt and change itself and recommit with herself, you know? And so she said, we don't need to take care of land. We don't need to take care of the earth. We just have to respect it and let it be.
Right.
Could that be the case? The ocean?
The ocean, I wish I could tell you yes. Over time, of course, that's true. Over time, the ocean's pH levels will return to normal, to what, you know, they have been for the last, you know, millions of years. But until we stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that process of acidification will continue. It will continue. If we keep on doing, you know, what we're doing now until the middle of this century, the ocean will be more acidic than scientists think it has ever been in the whole history of the planet. So we have to take some steps before we can let nature heal. Like we have to get ourselves out of the way before we can do that and some of our, you know, our damage out of the way. Over time, the ocean will return to normal, but that's in geological time, which means tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years, not in time for us to bear witness to it. So, you know, what's at stake here is, of course, not life on the planet, because life will continue. What's at stake here is life as we know it on the planet. That's what's the issue.
Why do you think that environmentalists are not talking much about the implications of overfishing and animal products consumption?
Yeah.
Because, as you might know, for example, livestock
yeah.
is the main cause of deforestation in the planet.
Right.
And I have seen lots of conferences, and I think almost nobody talks about it. And it's something that it has implications for the consumers.
Right.
Because we are consuming, as far as I understand, too much animal products, including
right.
fish and everything, you know?
Right.
So I wanted to know what's going on in the environmental world that nobody's speaking about this point, which is so dramatic.
Yeah, and in fact, it depends what part of the world you're in. I mean, when I was in Copenhagen at the climate talks a year ago, the whole issue of eating animal flesh and fish flesh was huge. It was a huge part of the discussion of the environmental community that was there. So it was everywhere. It was a big part of the agenda. And in North America, it's getting to be a bigger and bigger part of the agenda. But as a whole, you're right. It's not, you know, there isn't enough discussion about it. And I think it really, unfortunately, the environmental movement around the world seems to be a little bit, it seems to be very fractured. So in North America, for example, you have people who are, you have environmental groups that are focused on saving, you know, species, and then you have others that are focused on making sure that the land is intact, and you have others that are interested, you know, they have special issues, and they're not coherently talking about, you know, the big issue, which is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is, you know, the one, if they gathered around to think about it, they would have to deal with that one. And that, I think that fracturing is happening in the environmental movement around the world, and it's making it less effective than it needs to be. In my experience, and I hope this isn't going to offend every, you know, people in the crowd, the people who are the greatest environmentalists tend to be local organizers who don't even necessarily call themselves environmentalists, and they're not necessarily affiliated with some of the big environmental groups, but they are acting for their own communities, and they are an incredibly powerful group of people around the world, no matter which country you go into, and that's where I place my hope on the international stage. Anybody else?
Yes. I have a question. As a journalist, and you have written a book.
Who am I talking to?
In the back?
Oh, sorry. Okay.
As a journalist, how do you see your responsibility of all journalists to bring such an important issue, but it will pale and people get bored of the same thing that's a continuing story over and over again?
Yeah.
And this is something where people have to change their day-to-day decisions to be more conserving of the carbon dioxide, so there's less carbon in the atmosphere.
Right.
So I just wondered if you could address what journalists can do to help address this problem.
You know, people ask me that a lot, and I, you know, for me, as a journalist, my job is not really to crusade. It's not to try to, it's not to give people a recipe for what they can do or should do. For me, my job, as I see it, is to democratize the information that's out there. So there's all of this information, this incredibly robust scientific information that is there telling us what the issues are. My job, I think, is just to try to explain that to people so that they can make informed decisions about what they do. I mean, you people, all of you here, now know what the issues are. I would hate, you know, to give you a shopping list of the things that I think you should do to try to resolve this issue, because I don't know what your particular decisions are going to be on it, and I don't want to tell you what they should be either. I don't think that's my task. My task is to tell you what I think is going, what scientists are finding out, and hopefully unleash your imagination and creativity. I mean, if every single person in this room today is awake all night thinking about what it is that you can do to fix this, then great, I will have succeeded. But I'm not going to tell you that if you tick off all of these things on a list, everything's going to be okay, because it's not. It's going to take everybody working together with all of your creative imagination to make a difference, I think.
Gracias.
Yes.
¿Cuál cree usted que ha sido la causa por la cual la gente...
Perdone.
¿Cuál?
No está oyendo.
Está. ¿Cuál cree usted que es la causa por la cual la gente no ha tomado conciencia real sobre la problemática ambiental que vivimos, sobre la destrucción de nuestro propio planeta? Yo conozco muchísima gente que se muestra preocupado, de pronto ahorita después de que escuchen esta charla salen y dicen, ay sí, los océanos, qué pesar, cierto, pero siguen, después de unas horas van a seguir una vida normal, no están dispuestos a sacrificar sus comodidades, siguen siendo parte del consumismo. Y todo. Entonces, ¿cuál será la causa por la cual la gente de verdad no toma conciencia?
It's a fantastic question. Of course, it's the thing that keeps me awake at night, is that exact question. But, you know, part of it is that, you know, we're still not very different, all of us here, from when we painted ourselves blue and lived in caves. We're not really very much different from that. And we survive, right? Survival is our immediate, today's survival is the key. So we're not necessarily looking at how to make sure that the forest survives or the ocean survives over time. We're thinking about how do I get enough food today for me and my family. So there's still that built in. That's one issue. Another issue is that it seems so huge. It seems so enormous to you know, if we're affecting the global ocean, you know, how do we ever tackle that? So it's a sense, I think, of both of, I think, a sense that we are insignificant and we couldn't possibly have the effect that we're having. And then also that if it's really that bad, we'll find a way to fix it. You know, we're very vain species. So I think and both of those are wrong. We are affecting it and we will not find a way to fix it unless we, you know, reduce carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. But it's a fascinating phenomenon, and the thing that makes it so fascinating to me is that there have been other times in our species history when we have changed things. We have made big changes because they were the right things to do. So slavery, giving women and poor people votes over time. I mean, there have been all sorts of shifts in human understandings of how the world works that have happened because we just thought they were right. Today, I mean, we have all of these ways of communicating with each other that we never had. We never had in, you know, even 20 years ago. We can actually get together and do things as citizens. We can, I mean, if we really wanted to, we could tell our politicians that they have to do some things about this, because it's not all up to us. We have representatives who are supposed to be, you know, representing us at these big international meetings, and they're failing us. Maybe they're failing us because we haven't told them that they have to do it. So, you know, I don't really agree with you that people just forget about this stuff. I think that what I perceive is this very, very loosely knit but very strong movement around the world of people who really care very deeply and are doing things about this. And I think it's hard to put your finger on, but it's there. And I don't think it's translated into huge action at the international stage, but it certainly has at individual levels. Is it enough? No. But it's a start. Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
What state would the world have to be in, do you think, for even the most ignorant people to start believing and doing something about it? And do you think from that point we would be able to fix it?
I think it's going to have to happen before that state. I mean, the sad, you know, I hate to depress you, but we have a very small window. We have 5 or 10 years at the absolute outside. And that's generous. Actually, things need to happen really fast. And this is to do with, you know, a plan to get carbon dioxide emissions down and concentrations down as well. And for the kind of catastrophe that you're talking about, I think that it will go past that window. So I think that we have to try to you know, encourage people on this before it gets to that catastrophic state. We really have a very small window. We're right here as we sit here. The carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere are 393 parts per million by volume. If it gets to 450, that's, you know, many, many scientists think that is well past the place of no return. And that could happen within a decade. So I have nightmares about that one. I have no good answer. Anybody else? You have a question. Yeah.
Sorry.
We have one more.
All right, I have a simple question. The world population is about like 6 billion people now, and it's supposed to go up to about 9 billion people in 30 or 40 years.
Yep.
Do you think that a population of 9 billion people is compatible with a sustainable Earth?
No, it's incompatible. It cannot happen. And if you're a scientist, that's not the first thing you worry about, though, because, frankly, population is a self-correcting issue. If the planet gets to the kind of state that we're talking about, human population will not be the big problem. I hate to say. Thank you very much.